Well, so moving into the COVID-19 update, we are seeing that case rates are rising nationwide at this point, primarily driven by case rates in the Northeast and now also in the Midwest as well. We're also starting to see case rates rise in the West Coast, particularly in Washington and California at this point. One hopeful sign that we are seeing is while we are seeing case rates rise throughout the country, we have not yet seen a rise in hospitalizations or deaths. And those actually continue to downtrend at this point. We are seeing some of the lowest rates that we have seen in quite some time when it comes to hospitalizations and deaths. I do want to always remind folks, we are still seeing quite a few deaths due to COVID-19. We're seeing 500 deaths per day in the United States. In an average bad flu season, we see between 30 and 80 deaths per day. So it's still quite a bit more than we would generally see from other infectious diseases, but it's down quite a bit from where we were in the past. In Washington, we are also seeing case rates. We're seeing case rates start to rise. Initially, that started in the I-5 corridor, but we're now seeing it in our area, and we're starting to see it trend into the east side of the mountains as well. We are definitely at a point where our case rates are being quite a bit affected by what's called case ascertainment, which is our ability to detect those cases. As so many of us have moved to home testing, that's really affecting the ability of different counties to detect those cases. In the I-5 corridor, they have very good case ascertainment, and so do we in Jefferson County. We have an online form where people can submit if they've had a positive home test, and really our community is doing that. So we're doing a really good job of detecting the cases that we have in our community, but different parts of our state are doing better or worse at that. In Clallam County, we are just this week debuting the ability to submit a positive home test online at our COVID-19 website. And so we're hoping that that will help us pick up more of our cases in Clallam County. And we think that is driving some of the difference, not just between our two counties, but really across the state. There are many parts of the state that use exclusively antigen tests, and that is, and those are rarely reported, especially on the east side of the state. So it's starting to limit our ability to assess the number of cases. But in Jefferson, I do think we still have a good sense of how many cases we have in our community. So in Jefferson County, our case rates, our total cases are 3,295. That puts our case rate at 270 cases per 100,000. So we are in that high risk zone where we strongly recommend masking in indoor spaces, regardless of your vaccination status. Our percent positivity is also up at 8.5%. We fortunately have no one in the hospital for COVID-19 at this point, for a total of 118 hospitalizations. We have no new deaths, for a total of 28 deaths in Jefferson County. In neighboring Clallam County, we have had 11,148 cases diagnosed for COVID-19. That puts our case rate at 117 per 100,000 with a percent positivity of 5%. We have two individuals currently in the hospital for COVID-19 in Clallam County for a total of 364, and no new deaths to report at 111. So as I discussed before, I think we are picking up fewer of our cases in Clallam County. On any given day in Jefferson County, about 70 to 90% of the cases we are reporting are actually home antigen tests that people have reported to the health department, and then we've been able to interview them. Comparatively, in Clallam County, about 10% of our cases on any given day are home antigen tests. And we do believe that home antigen tests are used similarly across the counties. And so we think we're missing a chunk of cases in Clallam. And we're hopeful that by making it easier to report, by putting up a space on the website where people can securely report their positive home tests, we'll get a little bit better ascertainment of cases in Clallam County as well. I think a couple key details to look at with COVID-19 at this point. We are certainly seeing cases rise. We think that's driven by the BA2 variant. That's now about 75% of the positive tests that we're seeing in Jefferson and Clallam County. So it is the dominant variant here. We also think that rise is driven by the reduction in mitigation measures that we're seeing. Less masking, it's not mandatory anymore. And so taking away those mitigation measures has certainly also contributed to the rise in cases that we're seeing. One hopeful point that we are seeing, though, is we are still not seeing a rise in hospitalization and death, not just here, but also not on the East Coast, that had a rise in cases earlier than we did. And so this could be one of the first times that we don't see a case rate rise followed by a rise in hospitalizations. We're going to keep watching that very, very closely. And certainly if we saw that in other parts of the country, that might change our mitigations here. But so far, we're not seeing that happen. And that's really the trigger that would cause us to change some of our mitigations locally, is if we saw a rise in severe disease, hospitalization, and death. We are hopeful, though, that we might not see that this time. That's because so many of us are vaccinated. We've gotten our vaccines, we've gotten our boosters, and so many of us had a recent infection with COVID-19. And so between those two, we are hopeful that we can prevent severe disease. We'll keep monitoring for it, though, and absolutely we'll update you if we start to see that kind of a trend. We are also lucky because we are following behind other parts of our country. So we have a little bit of time to watch what happens there and adjust our measures if we need to. The only other big update I want to share today is that we are seeing rising rates of influenza locally as well. Particularly, we're seeing this in Clallam County, where there is less masking than we see in Jefferson, but we're starting to see it in Jefferson as well. In Clallam County, we have had our first death due to influenza this year. It was a man in his 50s who had underlying conditions who was not vaccinated. And so I think now is a really important time. If you have influenza yet, it's a really good time to get vaccinated. It's important to remember that while influenza is less dangerous than COVID-19, it still can be quite dangerous, especially for people who are very young, for people who are elderly, or for people who have underlying chronic conditions. So even if you're not elderly or very young, as this man was, if you have underlying conditions, diabetes, lung disease, any of those kind of underlying conditions, any heart disease, though, it's really, really important for you to get vaccinated against the flu, not only to reduce your risk of getting the virus at all, but particularly to reduce your risk of severe disease due to the virus. It's also important to remember that masks work for both. They work for COVID and they work for flu. So it'll reduce your risk of getting both if you wear a mask in indoor spaces. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions from our commissioners.
I have one, and it was conversation around my house this weekend. So can you clarify the recommendations for the second booster shot or the fourth shot? Because we were almost arm wrestling over whether I needed it. I'm 51. And whether my husband needed it, he's 63. And my mom. So,
there's a lot of questions about the boosters, and I think that there have been breakdowns in how the booster recommendations have been communicated. So at this point, there is an option for a second booster, which is a fourth dose, for anyone 50 and over in the United States. The data around that booster is that it is safe. It's definitely safe to get. It's not going to hurt you. It's not clear yet that it's needed, though. Because we are still seeing excellent protection from three doses. So the most important thing to do to prevent your risk of severe disease is to get vaccinated and get that first booster. So three doses for most of us. If you are immunosuppressed, that fourth dose is really critical. So if you're taking immunosuppressing medications, if you have a genetic immunodeficiency, if you're getting treated for cancer, or if you have had a cancer in the past that's been successfully treated, all of those folks, really good idea to get that fourth dose. Everyone else, it's not clear yet how necessary it is. It's certainly a reasonable option, and we support folks in getting it. The fourth doses are available locally at our healthcare system, at the pharmacies, and at the public health department. We're just not strongly recommending it yet because we're not yet seeing severe disease, even for people who are over 65, if they've gotten that booster. But adding that extra layer of protection is very reasonable. It's important to layer your prevention strategies. So even if you get that fourth dose, we do still strongly recommend wearing a mask in indoor settings. And if you are truly immunosuppressed, in addition to getting that fourth dose, I would recommend talking to your doctor about Evusheld, which is a monoclonal antibody that can provide you additional protection as we see case rates rise. So it's an option. It's not a strong recommendation at this point.
Thank you.
No worries.
I have a follow-up to that. And having just been in DC where there's, you know, quite a bit of COVID prevalence, it's interesting to see how many people who were boosted with one booster were getting COVID. And so curious if that is a timing thing that the first booster has worn off, or where there's just more prevalence, there's going to be more breakthrough cases like that. And if that changes the decision-making formula for the second, if you're going somewhere where there is more prevalence, would that be a reason to get a second booster if you're on the fence about it? I heard somebody describe BA2 as the cleanup crew. Anybody who didn't get Omicron the first time around is, you know, like BA2 could be the cleanup crew coming for everyone else. So just curious if you can help me understand that a little bit more. It was mostly congressional staffers who had a number of meetings canceled last week because so many of them who were boosted had COVID.
Sure. So yes, we will always see more breakthrough cases when we have more community prevalence. And particularly looking at Washington, D.C., we've seen a pretty broad unmasking in indoor spaces. And I think that has driven a lot of breakthrough, partly because Washington, D.C. is really sticking with the CDC masking recommendations, which is not to start masking again until your hospitals are overloaded. And I want to be clear, I disagree with those. I think we should mask long before we overload our hospitals. And so I think that is driving a lot of the breakthroughs you're seeing in DC, is just a lot of people meeting indoors with large crowds of other people without masks on. And so I think that's where we're seeing a lot of breakthrough happen. I think it is important to know when we speak about vaccine efficacy, what we're talking about. And so our ability for the vaccines to prevent all infections, they're not 100% at that, far from it. We do still see getting vaccinated reduces your risk of getting infected at all. But where they do the biggest work is by preventing you from getting severe disease. So it is still possible to get a breakthrough, even if you're vaccinated. It's less likely than if you're unvaccinated, but it can certainly still happen. But you are very, very unlikely to get severe disease. So we're seeing 99.9% efficacy against severe disease for those who are vaccinated and boosted. So really good prevention against the worst outcomes of COVID-19. But the longer it's been since you got your booster, the more likely you are to get a breakthrough at all. The getting a fourth dose does decrease your risk of getting any breakthrough. However, the protection from that is relatively short-lived. Unfortunately, we're seeing protection from all infections, a boost beyond that booster, really only adding extra protection for about a month after you get it. So if, for example, you're going to be doing something high risk, you're flying into DC, you're going to be meeting with tons of people in indoor spaces, it might be reasonable to get a booster before you do that, get an additional booster before you do that. But the added protection that it provides on top of a third dose isn't very long lasting. So that's part of why we're not pushing it so hard right now. I think we have to shift our thinking about what the vaccines do for us. Initially, when we were dealing with original virus, when we were dealing with Delta, it was able to prevent us from getting COVID at all. Now what the vaccines really do the best at is keeping us from getting COVID that hurts us in serious ways. So it dramatically decreases your risk of getting hospitalized, dramatically decreases your risk of dying due to COVID-19. It also reduces your likelihood of giving COVID to someone else if you get it, which is really important. It reduces your risk of long COVID, which is also really important. So that's what the vaccines do for you. They don't make you bulletproof. They don't make it so that you could never get COVID. And so as a person who's vaccinated and boosted myself, when I go into indoor spaces, I wear a mask because that's really one of my best protections against getting COVID at all and against the unlikely chance of me getting it and giving it to someone else. So that's the way I personally choose to layer my mitigations is I got vaccinated and boosted, and I wear a high quality mask in indoor spaces. In that way, I feel very confident that I'm not going to get COVID and I'm not going to give it to someone else.
Great, thank you. And just one quick question. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the cases that we're seeing in Jefferson right now? Does it tend to be fairly isolated to particular families and localized outbreaks, or is it widespread in the community now that we're back in high risk?
Great question. So we are seeing COVID pretty broadly across the community. With these case numbers, we are able to investigate them pretty thoroughly, and we're not seeing one primary driver of the cases. We're seeing cases across the county. We're seeing it in all different parts of the county and in a variety of venues. One of the most common things we are seeing in our cases right now is that those who got COVID spent time unmasked in a variety of indoor venues. And so it's harder to trace it to an individual venue. They went to stores, they went to restaurants, they went to school unmasked. And so there's a bunch of different places where it could potentially have come from. And so the most common unifying factor we see in those who are getting COVID right now is they're going indoors unmasked somewhere. That's really how it's happening. We certainly are seeing family gatherings too. So kind of bigger groups meeting up indoors to celebrate in unmasked settings. So that's really the biggest driver, but it's not one industry or one particular outbreak driving all of it. It's kind of people all across the county who are getting it. And so biggest thing you can do besides being vaccinated and boosted, wear a mask in an indoor setting and make sure it's a good quality mask. So at least a surgical mask, a KN95 or KF94 will provide you even better protection for yourself. All of the masks protect you from giving COVID to other people, but the higher quality masks reduce your risk of contracting the virus.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
I just have one question about, I guess, the international stage. I'm just wondering if you can give a little bit of context. I see the struggles that China's having right now, and I appreciate the national and the local, but just how is the world doing right now in your analysis?
Variable, depending on what part of the world you're in. A lot of what we're seeing driving different levels of COVID-19 activity is we're just seeing very different responses to the virus, and we're seeing the outcome of those different responses over time. So for instance, China, Hong Kong had very stringent zero COVID policies, and in many cases still do. And so they really handled COVID by lockdowns primarily, but in many cases did not have a commensurate vaccination effort to back that up. And so they were able to stop COVID-19 from transmitting when it was Delta, when it was original COVID. But once Omicron hit, once BA1 and BA2 hit, it got around those levels of lockdown. And so once it got into those communities, if there were large pockets, particularly of elders who were not well vaccinated, we're seeing severe disease in those spaces. And so that's really what's driving a lot of the spikes in cases, and in some places, hospitalization and death. In other parts of Southeast Asia, we've seen, and in some parts of China, different provinces handled it differently. In some parts of Southeast Asia, we're seeing that they did have really high quality vaccination efforts where large numbers of elders were well vaccinated. And so they're still seeing spikes in cases, but they're not seeing hospitalizations and deaths. And so that's really where we're seeing things shake out. If you see a spike in hospitalizations and deaths, usually that appears to be driven by under vaccination, particularly of elder members of the population. I think with Omicron and Delta, it's not possible to have a zero COVID strategy. It's not possible to make sure we don't have COVID. What we can do is reduce the rates of COVID so that we don't overwhelm our hospitals, and we can make sure people are well vaccinated so they're very unlikely to need a hospitalization. That's kind of the big breakdown we're seeing there. In some parts of Africa that had very large Omicron waves, they're behaving a little bit more similarly to what we're seeing in the United States. We're seeing some rises in cases, but we're not seeing commensurate rises in hospitalization and death. That's been the South African experience.
Great.
So I guess, were there any other countries you were wondering about?
No, that's very helpful. And I guess, I mean, you touched on it a little bit. We haven't heard about herd immunity for a long time, as you know, people are getting reinfected. But it does sound like that is a factor that's pretty important. The lockdowns, it sounds like you're saying that a downside of the lockdowns is that when, you know, something like BA1 and BA2 come in, they can get around the defenses of the lockdown. There aren't any other defenses. So the layered mitigations, I guess.
Yeah, the layered mitigation is really critical in those kind of spaces. And I should say that we haven't had a full lockdown in the United States in a very long time. And we never had a lockdown the way they did in China. That was a whole different level than what we did. We really transitioned to vaccination and masking. And I would say if we're considering any future mitigations, which we are always keeping on the table if we need it. We're looking at masking. That's really the primary mitigation. So making masking mandatory if we started to see significant rises in severe disease. Luckily, we're not seeing that yet. And so we're hoping to be able to manage this by just giving people good advice, helping them understand how much COVID's in the community and what to do to protect themselves. And so that's why we have the dial up. That's why we're trying to really get a good handle on how many cases we have, is so you can have all the best information to protect yourself and your family. I think the one other mitigation that's really important for folks to know about is treatment. And so if you do get COVID and you are high risk, particularly if you're elderly or if you have underlying conditions, if you get a breakthrough, regardless of your vaccination status, we want to treat you. And we have good treatments available. So it's important to get tested right away. And then if you live in Jefferson County, call the COVID hotline. If you live in Clallam County, call your medical provider. And we have treatments available to protect you so that you don't get that severe disease. I think if we layer vaccination, masking, and treatment, we can prevent severe disease from COVID-19. But we just all need to be on board with using those mitigations.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And I think it's important whenever we talk about what's happening in other parts of the world to acknowledge that not all of us have had access to all of those things. So it's not that, you know, some countries have chosen different policies, but a lot of countries just don't have access to those things. Much of the world does not have access to the kind of treatments we do in the United States. And so that is certainly affecting the proportion of severe disease we're seeing in other parts of the world. Okay, so any other questions from the commissioners before I dig into the KPTZ question?
I think it's on to the KPTZ list. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Berry.
We have a few today. The first question asked basically if it's possible to get long COVID, even if you didn't know you had COVID, and get kind of persistent fatigue and shortness of breath, even if you were never diagnosed with COVID. And I would say it is. We do have people who got long COVID, especially in the early parts of the pandemic when testing wasn't widely available. And so in those cases, often we find out that they did have COVID and they just didn't know. And so they, you know, they had what they thought was the flu, and they just didn't get tested. And then later we can find out from antibody testing that they did have COVID and they've had persistent symptoms thereafter. I would say long COVID is more common with people who had severe disease due to COVID. So you are more likely to have known that you had COVID, but if you didn't get diagnosed, if you didn't get tested, it is possible to develop long COVID, whether you knew you had COVID or not. It's also important to know that the symptoms of long COVID can be caused by other things, including other things that are important to diagnose and treat properly. So if you're having symptoms of long COVID, persistent shortness of breath, persistent fatigue, brain fog, things like that, it's important to go get properly evaluated by a physician because there are other things that can cause that are treated differently. And so you want to get properly worked up so we can make sure that we do treat that, things like thyroid disorders, things like other more serious medical problems. We want to make sure we properly diagnose which one you have so that you can get the treatment that will help you the best. This person asked, what do you think of the commercial aviation mask mandate going forward? So the mask mandate for public transportation, including planes, trains, automobiles, buses, things like that, has been extended. And I do think that's a good idea. Public transit is one of the highest risk areas for transmitting COVID-19. And you can imagine why. There's a lot of us. We're indoors, often in a space where there's no windows that open, and we are sharing the same airspace for an extended period of time. And so I think having a higher layer of mitigation in those spaces is appropriate. When it comes to planes have excellent air filtration systems, but airports don't. And so when you're in an airport, that's a really high risk area. And often those filtration systems are turned off during taxi, takeoff, and landing. And so, it's important to wear a mask on planes because it's mandatory, but it's really, really important to keep your mask on in the airport. And then basically until the seatbelt sign turns off, that's going to be the most important time to protect you. So even if you're going to take a break to have a snack, take a drink, I try to save that until you're at cruising altitude when those fans are on. What are your thoughts on traveling across country on an airplane? So this person had a very similar question, kind of about the risk of that kind of travel. And this person in particular is immunocompromised, and so was wondering whether or not it's a reasonable risk to take to fly. I would say, I think flying can be done well. The most important thing, if you're going to fly, is get vaccinated and boosted. This person is. They got their fourth booster as well because they're immunocompromised. And then to wear a high quality mask. So at least a KN94 or a KF94 or a KN95 or an N95 if you can keep it on your face. Really, really important to wear it throughout the airport terminal, takeoff and landing. And then if you need to take it off to take a drink, have a snack, if it's a cross-country flight, that's okay. But really try to keep it on the rest of that flight. And then pay attention to what you're doing when you arrive. So a lot of folks will be very, very careful on their flight. And then they go indoors for a 30-person indoor gathering. That's a risky move. So if you are immunocompromised, you really want to wear a high-quality mask in all your indoor settings. If you're going to be meeting up with a small group of folks, adding antigen testing on board. So if you guys all take an antigen test before you meet up for dinner, that can make it safe to remove your mask in those kind of spaces. So I would think about layering all those mitigations. And then I think traveling can be done safely. You just have to be very intentional about it. And the one place where you are most likely to get surface transmission of COVID or other viruses is actually TSA. So it's when you touch those bins that all of us have touched throughout many, many days. You want to wash your hands after TSA. If you do all of that, I think you can do it quite well. But everyone has to make their own risk assessment. And so if all of those mitigations, if thinking about COVID that much on your trip is going to make it not very fun right now, then it might be reasonable to delay it. But if you have a really meaningful thing you want to do, if you really want to see family that you haven't seen in a couple of years, I think you can do it well. You just need a high quality mask, you need to keep it on. Otherwise, we just have a couple more. One person asked about the second booster for the 50 and over crowd. So we kind of talked about that. If you are 51 and healthy, I don't know that there's a lot of indication for it right now. I think it's a very reasonable additional measure to take, especially if you're about to do something more risky. But I don't know that it's entirely necessary, at least not based on the data that we have in front of us at this time. If you are high risk, if you're 75, have multiple underlying comorbidities, and you want that added layer of protection just against the very rare possibility of severe disease, I think that's a particularly reasonable time to consider going forward with a fourth booster. But again, we're still seeing great protection from the first three shots. And so most important is just to get vaccinated and get that booster, which is for most of us, three shots. This person asked, will pediatric vaccines for the 5 to 12 age group be available in Jefferson County by early July? And so I just want to clarify, we have pediatric COVID-19 vaccines available right now for everyone 5 and up. So you can get those at Jefferson County Public Health. You can get them at pharmacies. You can get them at your local healthcare providers. Potentially what this person meant to ask was for the under 5 set that many of us are waiting for. And I'd say, I don't know. I haven't seen the data that is being submitted for the under 5 crew. I have heard the possibility of June for when we might see that vaccination become available, but we haven't seen the data. The FDA hasn't finished reviewing it. And so we don't know yet for the under 5 set. But if you have a kid 5 and up, they have vaccines available to them right now. We would encourage you to get them vaccinated if they haven't been already. Pharmacies, healthcare, or Jefferson County Public Health are all happy to take care of you.
Dr. Berry, does that include a booster for 5 to 12-year-olds?
For boosters, those are currently only approved for 12 and up. FDA is looking at the possibility of boosters for 5 to 12 right now. And so as soon as we see final decision on that, we would make those available as well. But we've not yet seen boosters for 5 to 12. Good clarification. One person asked, are bars and restaurants generating the new spike? If not, where is the new spike coming from? And so we touched on this a little bit with Commissioner Dean's question. We certainly are seeing visiting bars and restaurants in our case investigations, but often we're seeing that that person also visited a variety of other places unmasked and indoors. And so it's harder to pinpoint that that's exactly where it's coming from. There's just a lot of options for where people might have gotten COVID because so many people are unmasked in indoor settings. We do know that bars and restaurants are a place where COVID transmits because we're unmasked and indoors, but anywhere else that we're unmasked and indoors right now can also transmit COVID-19 if you spend a prolonged period of time there. So the best protection, besides getting vaccinated and getting boosted, is to wear a mask in all of your indoor settings. That will reduce your risk of getting COVID. And then the last one, this person says, I had COVID in early April. I have tested negative twice now. How much longer do I need to test at home before going into a small group indoor situation? I feel like I'm wasting antigen tests. So this is a good time to review what to do if you have COVID. So if you test positive for COVID-19, the most important thing is to isolate as soon as you find out that you're positive. And we recommend that you isolate for 10 days from when your symptoms started. So I don't know when this person's symptoms started, but say their symptoms started on April 1st. We recommend you isolate for 10 days beyond that, so until April 11th. What you can do is if after day five, so on April 6th, 5 days after your symptoms started, if on day five you have no symptoms at all, it is reasonable to take an antigen test. And if you are negative, to go ahead and leave isolation. So to actually go in the indoor environments, we do recommend that you continue to wear a well-fitting mask in indoor environments after that 5 days, even if you're testing negative. On the off chance that you have a low enough viral load that you're not testing positive anymore, but you could still infect others. So that's the way to leave isolation early, is if you test negative. If you've tested negative after day five, you can go ahead and leave isolation. You don't have to continue to test at home, but you do need to wear a mask until 10 days after your symptoms started. And that's all the questions we have from KPTZ.
Thank you, Dr. Berry.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if Willie is there, if he has anything he wants to add this week.
Howdy, good morning, everyone. Just two quick things from me. One, as it relates to masking, we had seen a pretty sharp drop off in demand in our free N95 and KN95 program. However, considering current case rates, we are gonna make another big push, make sure everyone is stocked up there. So those will be continue to be available at grocery stores, local libraries, et cetera. And you can find those locations on the Jefferson County Public Health website. Now, a reminder to folks that N95s and KN95s do provide really good protection to both yourself and those around you. So those, given our current case rates, are recommended whenever you're going into an indoor public setting. However, if you find those uncomfortable or you're not particularly concerned about yourself, we still really do recommend you wear even a cloth or a surgical mask to protect those around you. So, and given our current case rates, not mandated, but we really are encouraging that folks do mask up in those public spaces. So we'll be making N95s and KN95s available, and we're going to be getting rid of some of our stock of surgical masks as well. So really recommended if you be concerned for those around you. There are a lot of folks who might live with someone who might be too young to get vaccinated or can't for other reasons, or they might be immunocompromised themselves, et cetera. So pretty please do take advantage of that program and also do work to help protect those around you by masking up in those public. So we're making a push this week, restocking some folks and continuing to eye how fast those are going out into the community, even though it has slowed down pretty significantly. The other thing I wanted to touch on very briefly is that we are underway with our after action review process of the COVID-19 response. It's a little bit of a weird situation because we are still monitoring a current surge. We're certainly not done with our response to the pandemic yet. However, for the most part, in our operations here within the Emergency Operations Center has slowed pretty substantially. So we're taking this opportunity to look back and review what went right and what went wrong. Right now, we're in the process of soliciting written feedback from our partners and key stakeholders. And things are moving pretty slowly on that front. So I'd like to make a call to all of our partners who are listening to this, the other stakeholders who've received that request for feedback, that you reach out and take the time to provide us some written feedback. Really important to us to receive that, to help guide our after action report so that then we can utilize that information, make an action and improvement plan, and actually better prepare for the next pandemic or major event. So we're currently soliciting that written feedback for the next 2 weeks. So you do have a little bit of time there. The survey format we're using, it can be as long or as short as you like. Then after that, we'll be moving on to a series of small focus groups and more directed conversation around key functional areas. After that, we'll be kind of merging all the feedback together into one report. And then I'll be back to present findings to the public and the BOCC sometime around July, depending on how long our focus conversations take. So a call to our partners, if you haven't already, please do submit that written feedback. The response has been fairly low thus far. So we'd really love to hear from you. And again, help prepare for whatever COVID-19 has in store for us remaining, and then help us prepare for the next big pandemic or major disaster. So a call to our partners there. That's all for me.
Hey, Willie, just to shake the cobwebs loose a little bit and maybe inspire some of that feedback coming your way, can you give people example, just remind us of the key functions of DEM and what specific activities you're looking for feedback on, maybe the top 3 to 5, just to inspire people to go, oh, I have a thought on that.
Yep. So some of our key areas that we're looking at, obviously communications. So whether it be our public briefings alongside public health here at the BOCC, we had a series of internal stakeholder briefing calls that have morphed throughout the pandemic. Our situation reports, both internally to partners, as well as our community situation reports out to the broader public. Then everything from our PPE distribution, both to the public as well as to partners. Some of our planning work around other key issues like medical surge capacity, et cetera. Our vaccine operations, probably the biggest one within DEM in partnership with public health. And that also included spontaneous volunteer coordination. So we had hundreds and hundreds of folks who stepped forward from the community to help us deliver vaccine, to staff the Jefferson Healthcare vaccine operations, et cetera. So the Emergency Operations Center kind of serves as the central coordinating point among everyone involved in the response. So for this particular incident, it was a combination of DEM, public health, as well as Jefferson Healthcare. And so any way that Emergency Operations Center functioned, any of the coordination we did through information, personal protective equipment, or again, vaccine and other protective operations, whatever any of those might be. So if you're a stakeholder and you've received that that survey and that request for a response, and you're just not sure either where you fit in or if you need a refresher, and that's one thing we've really been finding is that 2-year-long incident response is much longer than anyone has ever served on. Most folks will deploy to an incident maybe for a couple of weeks. Many folks have been involved maybe for a few months at the very most in some sort of emergency response. So this is unprecedented. Some folks have needed some help jogging their memory a little bit. So do feel free to reach out and we can chat again about what your role was, about what we did, et cetera.
Perfect. That's just wanted the sparks to fly a little bit there. So I'm sure that some people are feeling inspired now. anything else from the commissioners for Dr. Berry or Willie this morning?
Nope.
Nothing from me.
Thanks, you guys. We really appreciate you being here. And as we have for the entire 2 years, your leadership and steady handling of the tiller as we navigate through this. So we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Great day.
Thank you.
Thanks.